to Book Spectrum. I'm your host, Chris Cordani. On Book Spectrum, we talk with both first-time authors and some seasoned writers from across the professional spectrum. With me today is one of the more proficient biographers in the field, but he's telling a story through the eyes of someone who has lived not within the world of the written word, but in the entertainment realm. Jay Margolis is with me to talk about the book My Meryl, Marilyn Monroe, Ronald Reagan, Hollywood, and Me. He tells this through the eyes of a lady named Terry Carger, who's known her since she was a little girl. Who is she? We're going to learn quite a bit about her and the very personal lives of both star actors, Marilyn Monroe, Ronald Reagan, and lots of other things with our guest, Jay Margolis. First off, the book's rather interesting. Tell us a bit, though, about Terry Carger.
Well, you know, she was born into a life of famous people. Her grandfather was Frederick Maxwell Carger Sr., and her father was Frederick Maxwell Carger Jr. But everybody called her grandfather Max, and he started Metro Pictures during the silent film era, working with Nazimova and Rudolph Valentino, who was his best friend. And when he died in 1922 at the age of 46 of a heart attack, Maxwell, you know, his Metro Pictures merged with Goldwyn and Mayer and became MGM, which is a big studio. So Terry just was born into this whole life of, you know, famous people. Her father was a composer at Columbia Pictures, got assigned to a then unknown Marilyn Monroe in 1948. And was able to train her voice to be very beautiful in a short amount of time. And you can see that clearly in Ladies of the Chorus in 1948, the picture that Fred was assigned to work with Marilyn on. Her voice is beautiful.
What makes her relationship with Marilyn Monroe extra intriguing are the facts that her, again, the father dated the movie star. She was a friend of the family, yes, as you've mentioned, even after they broke up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, even after they broke up. And Marilyn actually babysat Terry. That must have been fun.
It was very funny. Imagine the six-year-old, and this is actually mentioned in Marilyn's biography, but it's mentioned under a different gender. It says Fred had a son, but the truth is Fred only had a daughter. I guess they were trying to protect her identity by doing that, but, you know, Terry told me, so that I wish that they hadn't changed my gender for, you know, purposes of legal reasons. And so having a babysitter at age six, Marilyn Monroe, see, at that time, she wasn't known as a big movie star. But then, you know, when she got older, you know, Terry continued to grow up with Marilyn. And Marilyn was kind of like her big sister and kind of like her surrogate mother in a way, because they knew each other for 14 years. That's longer than Marilyn knew any of her three husbands.
Was she one of those strict babysitters, like a Frau from the house, or maybe more like Julie Andrews on The Sound of Music?
Well, she was more like, you know, go to church on a Christian Science church on Sunday. That was something that Marilyn learned from her Aunt Anna, who was the aunt of her guardian, Grace McKee Goddard. And so she had already been ingrained to go to Christian Science church early on. And so she was taking Terry there, and Terry's mother, Patty, who later became an entertainment lawyer for the stars like Cary Grant and even Leon Shamroy, who did Marilyn's first screen test. There was a Christian Science element in Terry's mother also. So Terry's mother was perfectly okay with Marilyn taking her to Christian Science church on Sundays, because Patty, her mother, was a very busy lady. She had no problem with Marilyn babysitting her, taking her to Will Wright's, you know, ice cream shop to get ice cream sundaes and watching people pass by and just having a general good time with this woman who was very sweet and just liked to, she loved children because they couldn't backstab her or make fun of her or do things that adults could be really mean about that she learned later in life.
With me is Jay Margolis, the author of My Meryl, Marilyn Monroe, Ronald Reagan, Hollywood, and Me, as told through the eyes of Terry Carger. This is not your first Marilyn Monroe book, Jay. Why would you say it was important to share Marilyn's story, particularly this time from Terry's perspective?
Well, because, you know, there has never been a book written from a child's perspective on knowing Marilyn, from a young child all the way up until Terry, from the time that Terry was six until she was 21. So this was something that was very unique. Nobody's actually known her that long. In fact, Terry's grandmother, Nana, became the mother that Marilyn never had because, as we all know, Gladys, her mother, was institutionalized at the age of seven, you know, when Marilyn was seven. And so this woman, you know, Ann Connolly, who, you know, everybody called Nana in Terry's family. Everybody has a Nana, in fact, and a grandmother, but they did call her Nana. And she was so important to Marilyn that Marilyn bought her a charm bracelet that was 14 karat gold. It says, "To Anne, with my deepest love and friendship, Marilyn." Imagine getting a gift like that in 1953 money. That must be worth a fortune. I mean, Marilyn would always spend money that she didn't have, and she would, you know, probably pay it on installments like she did for the gold watch that she got for Fred for the Christmas 1948. But that one wasn't engraved because Marilyn says, well, you'll find another woman and the present won't be much use to you if it had my name on it and not her name.
That's kind of funny. In reading the book, though, one cannot help but think about our overly celebrity-absorbed society where movie stars and some wealthy political families are treated as American royalty. On the one hand, there's the worship for many people and the adoration, but looking at the other side, and you see this all over today in tabloids and social media sites, celebrities are often treated as items, idols, commodities, two-dimensional targets of vitriol, without regard for the idea that these are human beings with real feelings and private lives underneath the makeup and expensive clothes, and away from the cameras. This book peels off all that superficial stuff, and that's why I believe it was important to hear from Terry Karger. What were some of the things you learned about Marilyn Monroe you really didn't find out when you were researching your other books just by talking with Terry?
Well, when I spoke with Terry, and I realized that Marilyn was a really generous person, you know, when Terry was about to have her a week before her seventh birthday, she went window shopping with her father, Fred, in Maryland, because, you know, Marilyn and Fred were dating at the time. And, you know, Terry says, "Hey, Dad, can you get that for my birthday? It's a blue dress with a white bow." And then, you know, Fred says, maybe next year. It's kind of expensive, honey. And so, you know, when it came around to, you know, Terry's birthday, she opens up the present that she sees, this big present, and she's like, "Oh my God, my father got me the blue dress with the white bow." But then when she looked inside, there's a little letter. It says it was from Marilyn, and she wanted to see Terry wear the dress, and she knew that she wanted it. So whenever Marilyn found out that somebody wanted something, more often than not, she'd get it for him, whether she could afford it or not. That was something I realized, is her overly generous nature, which is good. I mean, I don't know if it was because she wanted people to like her, but I think it was more because she wanted to make people feel good. And I think that was important, something that a lot of people don't know about Marilyn. She was also a very mischievous person. She liked to play pranks on people. She took a 7-year itch, you know, poster, put it on Jane Wyman's lawn, and Jane Wyman probably didn't like that very much. You know, she was going with Freddie Karger at the time. So it's kind of like a joke on Jane Wyman. And she used to do this with the Devilish Trio. See, Marilyn was part of the Devilish Trio, along with Terry's Aunt Mary, who was Fred's sister, and Terry's mother, Patty. Now, you think that Patty would be jealous of Marilyn for going after her ex-husband, but no, she didn't see it that way at all. Patty was an entertainment lawyer, and she became a very close friend of Marilyn, along with Aunt Mary and Marilyn, and they were called the Devilish Trio because they'd play pranks on people. And it was something that people don't really know about Marilyn.
This is interesting because we're talking about Marilyn Monroe, the movie star, and you're describing a woman who has developed some real relationships with people stemming off of maybe a 1-year relationship. And she stayed as a family friend and became kind of, as you said, a mischievous missy, if you will, with some of the ladies there. Did things in good, clean fun. There was no jealousy involved, or at least it seemed that way. And Ms. Monroe played something of, as you said before, a big sister and sometimes even life mentor to Terry.
Absolutely. She used to give her some good advice. She'd say, she'd ask Terry, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" When she's like 7 or 8 years old. And Terry would give different answers, say, "I want to be a spy," if they just come up with a spy movie, or say, "I want to drive an ice cream truck," if they just gotten an ice cream popsicle. And then sometimes she would just say, "Oh, I want to be a teacher." And then, you know, Marilyn, later on, and when Terry is older, when she was older than the child, and she said, you know, that Marilyn said, "Well, that's good that you want to be a teacher. People need to learn from people, and education is very important." And she said that looks will get you far, but not as far as a good education.
Wise words coming from Marilyn Monroe. I want to talk more about her, but you mentioned Jane Wyman in conversation here. Ronald Reagan is part of the title, and he became a friend of the family too. How did this all work out?
Well, what happened was when Terry was 11 years old, and this is 5 years after Marilyn Monroe, the babysitter, comes into the picture, you have Fred Carter, her father, marry an Oscar-winning actress, Jane Wyman, for Johnny Belinda. She plays a deaf-mute rape victim. She won the Academy Award. And so they marry on November 1st, 1952. The day before was, Halloween, 1952. So Michael and Maureen Reagan became Terry's stepbrother and stepsister. And they first met each other on the Halloween, which is the day before they actually, before Fred and Jane got married. And so that was interesting how they went trick-or-treating together. And they had no idea who each other were. And all of a sudden, their stepbrother and stepsister, they go swimming, get swimming lessons together. They play gin rummy in the morning. Michael Reagan played in the morning gin rummy with Terry every morning. They used to see the tour buses come around Jane Wyman's house, and they'd hide behind the bushes and come out and scream at the buses, and this bus would speed away in fear. They'd do a lot of funny things. Jane Wyman had an antique coffee grinder, so they took some cheeseburgers and see what would happen if they grind the cheeseburgers into the coffee grinder, and it made a huge mess, at which Jane Wyman made them clean it up.
Well, I would make them clean it up, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was her stepmother, Jane Wyman, Terry's stepmother, Marilyn Monroe, Terry's first and only babysitter. I mean, it's like a sort of like a Woody Allen type of Zelig thing where a character walks through history. I don't want to say Forrest Gump because Terry's not dumb or doesn't have a low IQ, but sort of somebody who walks through history. And the reason it was so interesting was because Terry didn't care about all that. And that's why people who were celebrities felt comfortable with Terry, especially Marilyn, because Marilyn wasn't trying to impress Terry with her celebrity. She just saw her as the human being and not the celebrity. And that was what Marilyn appreciated.
I believe a lot of people would appreciate that, too. I know the adoration's always fun for some people, but the fact is you can't confide in anybody if they don't treat you like a real human being.
Exactly.
Terry did interact with a lot of Hollywood figures as she grew up, as you said before. Talk about some of the other people whose paths she crossed you mentioned in the book. I don't want to give away too much from this side of the microphone.
Well, she ran into her favorite actress, June Allison, and June Allison came into Jane Wyman's house into Terry's bedroom and said, "Hey, Terry, I'd like to ask you a question. What do you think about my freckles? Do they look okay?" And, Terry's sitting there for the first time is actually somebody that she's starstruck to see, because it was actually her favorite actress. I mean, no offense to Marilyn or anything, but she knew Marilyn, so it was kind of, she was too close to her to really be that kind of judge. But June Allison was one of her favorite actresses, and she, got to see different people. Like, she went to Duncan Ronaldo's ranch when she was a kid, and he was very respectful from what she remembers. She got to meet just a lot of celebrities, like Cary Grant would come into her mother's entertainment law office, which later was run by Milton Cohen Jr., who her mother, Patty, ended up marrying after Fred. And they had, like, Cohen and Carter was their law firm. They had all these people, like Bing Crosby, Cary Grant, Leon Shamroy. They had just a lot of celebrities that were part of their clients. And while, Fred was teaching a lot of the stars to sing and improve their singing voice, Terry's mother was in the top, like, 200 entertainment lawyers in the country. And she was a woman during a time when being a lawyer was kind of a man's profession, in 1952. She also had a photographic memory like President Reagan, her mother Patty did. So she memorized the Bible and wrote little notes in there. And she was somebody who could recite facts off the tip of her fingers. And so she was a very smart woman. It was very well suited to be an entertainment lawyer.
With me is Jay Margolis on Book Spectrum. I'm your host, Chris Cordani. Jay wrote My Meryl, Marilyn Monroe, Ronald Reagan, Hollywood, and Me. It's through the eyes of Terry Carter, who we're talking about right now as well. Jay, since you have written books about Marilyn Monroe in the past, and we're discussing My Meryl on this episode of Book Spectrum, between all of your research and talking with Terry, who intimately knew the movie icon, as we've discussed as well, there have been suspicions about the nature of Ms. Monroe's death. It was reported, of course, a suicide. That's the narrative, but I'm not one to believe narratives. Right. Many have speculated murder. Let's talk about both yours and Terry's thoughts on this.
Okay. So, Terry found out through the radio at USC when she was 21 that, Marilyn had died, she remembered that they were thinking it was a suicide because it was very creepy that before even the autopsy performed, you know, they're already starting to, you know, the police are starting to push suicide or accident. Nobody's pushing murder at that time. And so, you know, she's thinking to herself, well, Marilyn would never commit suicide because, you know, Nana just talked to her the day before and everything was fine. Why would she kill herself the next day? She was so happy about getting rehired, you know, for Something's Got to Give, which was going to resume filming in October with Dean Martin. You know, so she hadn't been technically fired, you know, in the end with that. People tried to make it seem like she was fired, but the real story was that she had been rehired at a higher salary. So why would she kill herself? And not to mention that, when the autopsy was performed, there was not one undissolved capsule in her stomach. There were 20 cc's of a brownish mucoid fluid, according to the autopsy report, if you go down to the coroner's office and get a copy of it for $120. And you'll notice that there wasn't one refractive crystal from either the Nebutol or the chlorohydrate that was taken in a toxicology report. So what we're saying here is that there were enough drugs in Marilyn's blood to kill three people, but not one undissolved capsule in her stomach. So you could say, oh, well, maybe she did commit suicide, but not on an empty stomach with no undissolved capsules, and not with the equivalent of 47 Nebutols in her blood and 17 chlorohydrates in her blood. I don't say that she swallowed those pills. I'm just saying it's the equivalent of how many pills it would take to match the levels that were found in her blood.
I can just imagine this happening in the instant Twitter, Facebook, internet environment we have today. People coming up with things like you were saying, the forensics reports, posting pictures, posting ideas, and posting what their thoughts were and analyzing all of this. And of course, the suppression of information when the narrative is, hey, she committed suicide, we don't want to talk about anything else. The fact is, though, there are people who are suspected to be directly involved with her death. And I know you touch on that in some of your past books. How does Terry feel about possibly who might have been responsible for this sort of thing, or if there was a group of people who might have been?
Well, this is what she thought. She thought that she definitely did not commit suicide. That was from the very beginning. She knew that that was not something that she believed in. And the only reason that she didn't initially suspect murder was because, you know, they didn't really rule out accident until Thomas Noguchi wrote in his own book. He said, oh, well, it couldn't have been an accident because that's too many drugs having your blood by accident. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. So Noguchi was saying it's either suicide or murder. But Noguchi actually told the last professional photographer of Marilyn, George Barris's daughter, Caroline. He called up George Barris looking for George, and Caroline answered the phone. And Noguchi says, well, I always believed that Marilyn was murdered. They made me say certain things. It was a big cover-up, and that there's no way that she swallowed the pills because you'd expect undissolved capsules. She had to have been injected, and that she did not, you know, swallow the pills that killed her or the drugs that killed her. She didn't take the drugs. It was injected and it was entered through other ways. The problem with all this is that, you see, there's a CIA document that we put in Terry's book, and it's dated one day before Marilyn died. It's dated August 3rd, 1962, and it says that Marilyn was threatening to hold a press conference where she was going to expose the affairs with John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, and she was also going to expose information in her, what she called her diary of secrets, and what the newspapers would do with such disclosures about her knowledge about bases in Cuba and the secret plot to kill Castro by the president. And so she was going to reveal national security secrets. And so what Bobby Kennedy did was, on the day of Marilyn's death, he called up Dr. Greenson, her psychiatrist, and he knew that Greenson was having an affair, according to Peter Lawford. And he said, look, Greenson, not only is she going to go public with me and Jack on Monday morning, but she's going to go public with you too, which was a lie. It was just going to be Bobby and Jack and not Greenson. So Bobby used Greenson to get rid of Marilyn. And so there were five eyewitnesses, two Schaefer ambulance attendants, James Hall and Murray Leibowitz and Peter Lawford. They all said that Greenson killed Marilyn. And the two attendants said that it was with an undiluted pentobarbital injection to the heart. And then Greenson said, I'm going to pronounce her dead. You can leave. And he just got these attendants out of there. But he said, well, we were trying to save her. And this guy comes in and says, I'm her doctor. And you can't argue with a medical doctor. If you're an attendant, you have to let them do what they want to do. And so Peter Lawford said the following to corroborate the ambulance attendant. He said, Marilyn has got to be silenced, Bobby told Greenson, or something to that effect. Greenson had thus been set up by Bobby to take care of Marilyn. And not to mention that, but after 20 minutes after Greenson's injection, and in the Lincoln Continental sedan, you got Detective Lynn Franklin over on Olympic and Robinson Boulevard at 12:10 a.m., you know, 4 hours before Greenson officially calls the police on Marilyn's death. And you got Greenson in the front seat next to Peter driving drunk with his headlights off going 75 miles an hour. You got Bobby Kennedy in the back seat. And you got all these guys who were a part of the murder 7 miles from the crime scene. They're trying to get Bobby Kennedy back to San Francisco and pretend like he never left to go to Los Angeles.
Imagine that. If you have something on someone powerful, no matter who you are, you disappear somehow. That's terrible.
Yeah.
That's terrible. And of course, anybody who would bring up otherwise would be shouted down as a conspiracy theorist. You people don't know what you're talking about, because the government would never do anything like that. Powerful people would never do anything like that. Hey, they might have been exposed. We could have handled that. But no, that's a conspiracy theory, because I don't see any information about what she was going to talk about.
I just love when people make that argument, because it's basically armchair psychology. It's saying, well, people wouldn't do that, so it didn't happen. If we were to do that for every historical event in history, we wouldn't get the truth on history at all.
Exactly.
And remember, conspiracy is a legal term. It means that if there has to be at least two people or more who agree to commit an unlawful act in order for there to be a conspiracy. It sounds a little bit less crazy when you put it like that.
Oh, the term conspiracy theory has been thrown out to the point where it barely means anything anymore. It means you're questioning an established narrative, again, like the Marilyn Monroe suicide, if you will. It doesn't matter if it was a real conspiracy or not. You're just a conspiracy theorist, because you're up there with some of those weirdos that think the moon people are going to come take over the Earth sometime in the year 3746. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
They just want to make you look crazy for bringing up something that's plausible. Jay, what would you most like to have readers get from this book, My Meryl, Marilyn Monroe, Ronald Reagan, Hollywood, and Me?
I want people to realize that Marilyn was very much aware that she was being called the dumb blonde. She would, you know, quote herself as being aware that she said that, I don't care if I thought of as a dumb blonde. It's better than actually being perceived as a dumb blonde, you know. It's just, you know, she wanted to not go with this dumb blonde image just because she'd make movies like Gentlemen Prefer Blonde. She'd make How to Marry a Millionaire. She'd reject movies that were anything similar. She wanted the studio to allow her to do her own type of work. And that's why she did Bus Stop. And she also did The Prince and the Showgirl, because these weren't dumb blonde roles. They were actually roles that delved a lot deeper into someone who was trying to be a serious actress. And so she was trying to walk away from this whole dumb blonde myth. And the studios would perpetuate it because they thought that that's what was box office gold. They mentioned it and they say, we'll get you on the box office. But she really just wanted to be seen as a serious actress, just like anybody else who was trying to make it during that time and getting the Academy Awards like Jane Wyman.
Well, think about it. You make the money first and then you do what you want to do, because you're the draw.
Exactly.
Yeah. I understand you're also working on a couple of projects involving Robert F. Kennedy's death.
That is correct. I'm working on a full-length book on the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, where there are witnesses who actually saw a third shooter firing a gun who was not Sirhan Sirhan. I've spoken to two eyewitnesses who chose the same shooter out of a six-man photo lineup that was not Sirhan Sirhan, was not the security guard, because a lot of people thought that the second shooter who was firing a gun, they thought that he was the killer. It turns out there's a third shooter after the second shooter who fired a couple shots, and one of those shots went into Kennedy's head and killed him, and one went into the ceiling tile. And so this changes the whole narrative that we think we know about the Robert F. Kennedy murder, and that's going to be written solely by myself. And I have a second book on the Robert Kennedy assassination, I'm co-authoring with Scott Enyart. He's 69 now, but at the time, he was a 15-year-old Fairfax High School student working for his school newspaper as a photographer, and he was taking pictures as Robert Kennedy was being shot. And so this woman named Joan Barr immediately went to the police and said, hey, that kid was taking pictures as Robert Kennedy was being shot. So they went after him at gunpoint and took his pictures, and only returned the pictures that he took before and after the shooting, but not during the shooting. They kept those pictures. And Scott subsequently thought that they possibly may have been destroyed. And in 1996, he sued the city of Los Angeles, and he was able to get over a $600,000 judgment, but they reversed some of that judgment on appeal, accusing the jury of anti-police bias, which was just a way of the city trying not to get egg on their face you know, for losing this big, you know, case that was huge. You know, they didn't want to be seen as the losers in this thing. They hired the top lawyers in the country, like Lewis Skip Miller. And for him to lose that case was a real, you know, a bad thing for him. He didn't want to be seen as that type of loser.
Where was Jackie Childs when you need him? Didn't they know that Sirhan didn't they know that Sirhan Sirhan could not even be the guy that killed RFK? He didn't have three names.
A little guy.
He didn't have three names like all assassins do.
Well, actually, his name was Sirhan Bashara Sirhan. But, you know, we all know him like Sirhan as like we know Cher or Madonna. So, you know what I mean?
Right. Like but we don't know them like John Wilkes Booth or James Earl Ray or people like that. So keep that in mind.
Right. But another thing is that he couldn't have shot Robert Kennedy because he was facing him no closer than 2 feet. Facing him, he was in the wrong firing position. He was in what we call firing position A. The real shooters were in firing position B, which were directly behind Kennedy, less than an inch away from his head and on contact with the second shooter. So the second shooter jammed a gun up against his back, so that couldn't have been an accident trying to hit Sirhan. You know, when you jam a gun up somebody's back, it's not accidentally shooting them. That's an intentional act. So he shot him twice to the right armpit, the second shooter, Thane Eugene Caesar, and one bullet went harmlessly through his Kennedy's suit coat. And then there was the third shooter came in between Caesar, the guard, and Kennedy and shot him in the head. And he's the murderer because that headshot was the one that killed him. He would have still been alive had it just been the second shooter shot and not the third shooter.
Jim Margolis, thank you for being with us here on Book Spectrum.
You're welcome. Glad that you could have me.
The book is My Meryl, Marilyn Monroe, or Ronald Reagan, Hollywood, and Me. You co-wrote that with Terry Karger. The book is Through Her Eyes. It's very interesting. You can learn a side of Marilyn Monroe you've never known before. You can also learn a lot of the same things about Gene Wyman, Ronald Reagan, and some other Hollywood figures. This is a rather interesting take on Marilyn Monroe's real life. Not the accomplishments, not just the murder, but her real life, her relationships with obviously the Karger family, but also her mentorship, her big sister relationship with Terry. It's all interesting and something that's that'll give you something different from pretty much any other Marilyn Monroe book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Once again, thank you for joining us on Book Spectrum. I'm Chris Cordani. Thank you for listening.